comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet, thanks for being here. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. You know, back in 2000, when I first began broadcasting the Kevin Smith Show, I would advertise all the names of the upcoming guests. At first, there was no problem at all, but then as the show began to have global reach, we started being hacked frequently, and I noticed that this would happen most often when I was going to have a guest that was going to be talking about truly controversial information. So, kind of as an experiment, I stopped advertising who the upcoming guest would be. Voila, just like magic, the hacking took a nosedive. Now, it didn't go away altogether, as you know, but it was reduced by about 70%. So I've stuck with that practice of not advertising who our upcoming guests are to be. It is true that other shows advertise their upcoming guests without problem. It is also true that I am willing to ask questions that many of them fear to ask. And perhaps that's why we get hit when others do not. But some others do get hit. Mel Fabregas at Veritas Show is one of the few other hosts who will ask the deep and incisive questions. And it's no surprise that his show gets hit as frequently as the Kevin Smith Show does. Since my show is live, it is perhaps a bit more obvious when we're being attacked, when we're being hit. Mel broke a story this week on his show that is truly an important story. It featured an impromptu interview with filmmaker and investigative reporter James Fox, who was on location on the Gulf Coast. What Fox had to say was, to say the least, troubling. Now, my hat is off to Mel and the Veritas Show for this excellent reporting of information not being provided by lamestream media. I have talked with James Fox today by telephone and have scheduled him to be my guest one night this week. I'm not going to disclose the date of that interview due to the reasons that I stated just a moment ago. However, I do encourage you to tune in each and every night. Don't miss a single show, because if you do, you may just miss one of the most important interviews we will do this year. Additionally, on that night, I'm going to make the video free and open to everyone who comes to the Kevin Smith Show website to view it live. Of course, I encourage every listener to become a member of the Kevin Smith Show and enjoy our members' online television channel each night. It's only 23 cents a day to become a member at the Kevin Smith Show, and you get a real treasure trove of goodies as a member, including, but not limited to, watching the live shows, watching the latest show, chat, forums, a library of free ebooks, and our video galaxy. I also encourage you to sign up for our free weekly newsletter on my site, kevinsmithshow.com. It's called K-Files. We'll be back with Stephen Myers right after this. My guest this evening is Stephen Myers. Stephen is an author, lecturer, and independent researcher. He has studied the Great Pyramid for over 20 years to understand how this ancient wonder of the world was built and why it was built. His research included traveling to Egypt to conduct extensive on-site research at the Giza Plateau, and he's written numerous magazine articles, given many lectures on the subject of the Great Pyramid, and he has now compiled his research into a book called Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, and this is what it looks like, folks. And it's a good book. I've just completed reading it. It was excellent. And it is my pleasure to say, Stephen Myers, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me on the show. I appreciate this opportunity.
Well, you're certainly welcome. You know, your book takes a whole different approach than I think every other book I have read on the Great Pyramids, and I have read several books on the Great Pyramid, and I found it very interesting that you sort of take a feet on the ground, very practical approach of form follows function. Now, let me ask you, before we get into this very interesting bit of work that you've done here, why did you do it? What got you interested in the Great Pyramid?
Well, most of my work and also my background is very technical. I have the FCC first class radio telephone license. My degree is related to fluid mechanics, that type of thing. So I'm very interested in technology, but I'm also interested in history. And if a person is interested in history and technology, ultimately their focus of interest will be the Great Pyramid. It's a 45-story tall skyscraper that was built in distant antiquity, and it has some examples of some very high technology. So that's how I got interested in it.
I think whenever we say that it contains high technology, some people think only in terms of modern high technology. But it's not necessary to have the gadgetry we have today in order to have high technology, is it?
No, not at all. But ancient mankind was very similar to us, and they exhibited in ancient times throughout the world some very impressive technological feats, including brain surgery in South America. There's many skulls that show that people had brain surgery and also survived that. They did C-sections, medical C-sections in ancient Egypt. So both of those things are pretty impressive, something I wouldn't want to try. But those are some ancient technologies that ancient mankind was able to do. And then, of course, there's a host of others. But yes, ancient mankind can do some very remarkable feats.
You know, now this is a little bit off topic, except what I'm about to say is, except that you brought up that, you know, that they were doing surgery, and I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there are pictures of a doctor's kit of tools that from ancient Egypt that have been found, and I read an article where a modern doctor looked at that and he said, I can identify every one of those pieces. I know exactly what that is. You know, it's a little different form than the way we build them, but we still use those. And it was amazing.
Yeah, they had examples of some medical equipment at the Cairo Museum that I was able to see when in Egypt. So yes, it's very amazing the things that ancient mankind can do.
All right, let's go to the pyramid. Your book, Lost Technologies of the Pyramid. Now, you start off, fairly early in the book, you address the thing that has always bothered my mind, and that is everyone proposes things about this Great Pyramid without being able to substantiate what they propose. And that's okay as long as we understand that's what it is. Everyone's due an opinion. And you know, we can all speculate. But if you speculate that it is a power generator, then you need to be able to demonstrate it generates power. If you speculate that it is some type of, and I've read this fairly recently, mechanism for healing using audio frequencies, sound frequencies, then you have to be able to demonstrate that that's what it is if you want to move it beyond speculation. And so you've taken the approach of okay, let's look at the form of this pyramid and let's ask ourselves, what does this form suggest as its function? Now, I wonder if you would mind relating to the audience the example that you gave of the 1957 Chevrolet.
Okay. I told a story in the book to illustrate a point. Imagine the radio audience. Imagine that it was the year 1840, let's say, and they found a 57 Chevy at the base of the Great Pyramid in an excavation. That would be what would be called an out-of-place artifact. And it would be very unusual, certainly. It wouldn't run, so people would have to provide interpretations for its purpose. Well, a lot of Egyptologists would say that the steering wheel was round, which proved that the builders of this artifact tried to show us that the earth was round, or that the windshield was like a spirit screen so that a ghost could see through it or whatever. But anyway, if something like that was found in ancient times, Egyptologists would say that it would be like a four-person sarcophagus. And then they would develop a whole latticework of ideas about that. And but ultimately, when people could understand automobiles, then they could understand it was a self-propelled automobile that we would understand. But in the 1840s, they wouldn't. If somebody proposed that metal sarcophagus was a self-propelled car back in 1840, he would be considered a lunatic. So there was such a man that proposed that a similar idea to what the book is about. This man was Edward Kunkel, and he proposed an idea about the Great Pyramid, that it was built using water locks in a very sophisticated manner, and that the purpose of the Great Pyramid was that it was infrastructure for the civilization which built it, and that infrastructure served the purpose of pumping water. And that is the thesis of the book that I wrote.
Okay, so it's a gigantic water pump.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
It is a gigantic water pump.
All right, so now I've read the book, but I have to ask some questions here so that the audience is with us on this. What about the chamber that is called the King's Chamber that appears to have some kind of sarcophagus in it, although no evidence that anyone was ever buried there? What would be the purpose of that?
Well, the purpose of the King's Chambers, the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber, is rather sophisticated. Based on our research, we feel that sarcophagus, even though a person could fit in it, that it has no writing on it, no ornamentation to indicate that it was used for a funeral purpose. It has no hieroglyphics, no utterances from the Book of the Dead or anything like that. We felt that it was afloat in that chamber, and that chamber was at one time about half full of water, and the top half was full of compressed air. It's difficult to describe how the Great Pyramid worked as a water pump, although the book is well illustrated. But that float served to control automatically the water level in the king's chamber. And when the water in the top of the king's chamber area started to absorb into the water, the air, when the air was absorbed into the water, then the water level would go up, and then that sarcophagus, the coffer, whatever you want to call it, would provide feedback to a valve in the antechamber between the king's chamber and the grand gallery. But my book is primarily about the assembly process used to build the Great Pyramid.
Yeah. And but I think it's important for us to understand what you say the purpose is in order for us to really get a grip on the assembly process and why that's important. Because water played a huge role in the assembly as well.
Absolutely.
And so where did all this water come from that was used in the assembly of the pyramid and the functioning of it?
Well, there's scholarly debate about that. More than likely, the water came from ancient Lake Maurice, which is still there, and it is on the same side of the Nile River as the Great Pyramid. Herodotus spoke of canals between the Great Pyramid and the ancient Lake Maurice, which was much larger in ancient times. Also, Herodotus described the Great Pyramid as being surrounded by water. The Great Pyramid used to be used to have a wall around it, which is now gone. That wall survived up until the 18th century. The early depictions of the Great Pyramid show that wall, and that wall impounded a pond, a square pond that the Great Pyramid sat in. That's why he said it was like an island surrounded by a lake. So the source of the water to the construction site probably was Lake Maurice. There's certainly some scholarly debate about that. So that's where water came from. There's a lot of evidence for water on the Giza Plateau, certainly. Robert Schock talks a lot about water erosion on the Sphinx and the Sphinx enclosure in his books. He felt that much of that water was from weather, from rain, which would put the age of the Sphinx back possibly to the last ice age. But another possibility is the water that was eyewitnessed by the ancient historian Herodotus. So that's where the water came from.
Okay, now let me ask you this. Modern Egyptologists tell us, they call this Khufu's pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell us that it was built by Pharaoh Khufu.
Mm-hmm.
You don't subscribe to that, do you?
I do not.
And can you tell us who built it and why you don't subscribe to the Khufu theory?
Well, actually, the focus of our research is how the Great Pyramid was built and also why. It's actually beyond the focus of our research as to who built it. But,
let me narrow the question. If Khufu didn't build it, and it was already there when Khufu arrived, obviously someone before him had technology that was way, way beyond what we would have imagined for the time. And based on the other pyramids built during Khufu's time, it appears they didn't have the ability to build good pyramids during Khufu's time.
Absolutely. Egyptologists know a great deal about the culture of ancient Egypt. And basically a culture is the technology that they use and have available to them. That's the focus of our study, anyway, but it's nice that Egyptologists have offered a hypothesis. That hypothesis is Khufu built the Great Pyramid that is attributed to him. Yet, when I studied the Great Pyramid, I started with traditional books written by Egyptologists, and I read a bunch of them, as many as anybody probably, and I come to find out something that's very interesting that the books don't tell you. And it's kind of an important thing to remember or to become aware of. This really important, interesting fact that books about Egyptology, books about the Great Pyramid that Egyptologists have written, don't tell you. And that is, Egyptologists have never moved the largest stones, a payload that heavy, 1 inch. It's the entire science from its inception till today has never moved a payload as heavy as 70 tons, 1 inch. Yet, they say working people could do it, but they can't do it.
Well, you know, I saw that in your book, and that's one of the big things that I've said about all the theories about how this pyramid was built is, okay, if it was built by, you know, a whole bunch of slaves pulling big rocks on logs up a ramp that's 2 miles long, then just do it. Build one. You know, build one that's a third of the size.
Yeah, the Great Pyramid used to have casing stones that covered it. They were very precise stones, very large, that were cut extremely smooth, like 1/50th of an inch, over 5 by 7 feet. Egyptology, the entire science, has never recreated a casing stone. They've never made one, never even made one surface of one casing stone. They're highly educated, but they can't do what they say working people could do.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, that's very interesting.
It is very interesting. Did you know that they talk about a spiral ramp, a heavy stone, a full-size stone, even an interior stone, which is 2.5 tons, has never been moved around the corner of a spiral ramp.
Okay, Stephen, we have to step away for break. When we come back, I want to get into how this thing was built. We'll be back, folks, right after this break. Welcome back. We're talking with Stephen Myers. He is the author of a book called Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid. And Stephen, as we went away for break, you were saying this theory that they dragged these blocks up a ramp that encircled the pyramid. No one has yet ever put a bunch of guys with ropes on a block and dragged it around the corner of such a spiral ramp.
That's correct. It's never been done.
So how did they build this pyramid? Because I mean, you mentioned 70-ton blocks. How did they build this pyramid?
Well, it's interesting. There's an alternative way to looking at the Great Pyramid, and that is just to, with a clean slate, don't consider any religion or any gods or anything like that, or any tombs, or what its religious purpose is, or even its purpose at all. But you just have to realize that it was big, heavy stones, thousands of them that had to be moved, many without handling scars. The precisely cut stones did not have moving scars on them, so there must be a way to do that. And we started with a clean slate to try to understand how the Great Pyramid was assembled. Big heavy stones were moved from point A to point B and set in place in a precise manner. Egyptology, the entire science, has failed to exercise the scientific method to prove their ideas, their stories. Many of their stories are unprovable and can't be done in the real world, even though they say they were done by just working people. But imagine no Great Pyramid, just the plateau, and it was built kind of on a mound, if you will.
Okay.
But imagine the first level of casing stones were set in place, and they were able to fill out with water, so that was a square pond. And anyway, there were water locks from that pond all the way down to the Nile River. So stones on barges would move up a series of water locks from the Nile. Most of the stones were already on barges. Up inside and on that pond, if you will, floated on that pond, and then moved off the barge into the pond. And when that pond was filled with stones, the first level of the Great Pyramid was completed. Very systematic, and it's something that can be done in the real world. The Erie Canal was built 4.5 feet deep, and the barges could handle a payload, believe it or not, of 70 tons. Certainly a barge load of wheat or grain of 70 tons isn't exactly the same as a single 70-ton stone, but it's still a 70-ton payload that was able to be moved efficiently. And in fact, water locks are the technology of choice in the 21st century to move very heavy payloads.
But I think the question, though, would be, number one, how could they cut these 70-ton blocks with copper tools? And then how could they move them from the quarry to the barge? How could they load it?
Okay. That's a good question. I'll tell you what. The way they were cut is a high technology that's not fully understood. The way those 70-ton stones or even the 16-ton casing stones that were cut with extreme precision is a high technology of the Great Pyramid. That specific technology is still lost. It has never been demonstrated by anyone. But these water locks is not a lost technology to us. It's a lost technology that what is lost is the understanding that the stones of the Great Pyramid were moved using these water locks.
Yeah, but they still have to get them from the quarry to the barge. How did they do that?
Probably in a very similar way that they were moved off the barge to their final resting place. My book has several chapters that outline that process of moving these heavy stones off of the barges in a process that, let's say you have a heavy stone on a barge. We feel that barge allowed the stone to overhang the barge. So if the stone would overhang a little bit, it could be moved between two supports in the water. If you could put water in the barge, it would lower the barge and set the stone on those two supports. That's how stones were taken off of the barge. Then a specialized barge was used to move the stone from those two supports to the final resting place. There's a number of illustrations in the book that show that process. How the stones were moved from the quarries onto the barges was a very similar process in reverse. But our book, this particular book, concentrates on how the Great Pyramid was assembled more than the quarrying operation, if you will. That technology is still lost. There's books in every library in the world that tell you how it was done. The only thing is they are wrong. That's what makes me superior to the science of Egyptology, is that I know that I don't know how the stones were cut very precisely. Egyptologists know, but what they know is incorrect.
Well, yeah, it really has to be, because there is a scale that's used to measure the hardness of things and helps to determine whether the tool you're using is going to be able to cut the thing you're trying to cut. And the stones were much harder than the copper tools were able to cut. And so I've always thought that was kind of strange. But in just moving, you know, part of assembling the Great Pyramid, part of it has to be the moving of the stones. And we know that it boggles the mind to even try to believe what the Egyptologists tell us, that a bunch of slaves were dragging these gigantic stones with ropes and with on logs. That just boggles the mind. And plus the fact that it would have taken centuries to build the pyramid that way if you could build it. Using what you're talking about, the barges and floating down the Nile with these big stones, that's comparatively, that's rapid transportation.
The Erie Canal moved the entire weight of the Great Pyramid in less than 3 years. That's how much cargo was moved on the Erie Canal. So that's one thing. That's an interesting thing. But Egyptologists have offered a hypothesis, yet their science has stagnated and have not engaged in the scientific method. You know, it's okay to say working people made casing stones, you know, hundreds of thousands of them, let's say. But they can't even do it once for a demonstration. You know, I went to a local event in my area, and they had people that were reenactors reenacting the Civil War. And those people are more scientists than Egyptologists are. Those reenactors demonstrated the technology used during the Civil War. Egyptologists cannot demonstrate the technology that they say was used to do anything, actually. And in effect, because the whole science can't do many pivotal things that are required using the system they say it was done, since they can't do any of it, it's in effect a way to discredit their hypothesis.
Well, I agree. Now, have any examples of these barges that were used, have any examples of them been found?
There are no barge artifacts that were used in the Great Pyramid, none whatsoever. Yet, all Egyptologists and virtually all alternative researchers agree that there were barges. That's because the quarries, many of the quarries for the exceptional stones, were on the other side of the river. So the casing stones were a very high quality limestone, were quarried across the river and moved on a barge. The entire science of Egyptology has never moved a 16 ton stone on a barge or off a barge. It boggles my mind. Egyptology has become the phrenology of the 21st century.
All right, so these gigantic stones are coming down the Nile and coming through the canals to this pond, this square pond that's been built. Mm-hmm. And as you said, that square pond was still there around the pyramid when Herodotus saw it.
Yes.
Okay, so these stones are coming through the canals, and I guess, as a matter of fact, Dr. Schock, I believe, shows some examples of some of the locks, parts of the locks and sluice gates still in existence. And I've seen a documentary, I think it was Dr. Schock, that was in that documentary. But I have seen a documentary that shows some of the remains of the sluice gates. Now, they build this pyramid, but your book says they didn't have all these hundreds of thousands of slaves working on this and doing this. They didn't need all that, right?
No, they didn't need it. It's interesting that high precision usually indicates few people. If you go in a machine shop, it's full of like lathes and milling machines. It's full of that, but just a few people in there operating them. And if you work on a canal, let's say even the Erie Canal in the 1830s, there's maybe a couple of horses pulling a 70-ton barge and a person or two on the water locks. It took very few people to build the Great Pyramid. Exactly how many, certainly I don't know, but relatively few. And it was also very rapid. Egyptologists say a bunch of malarkey, like they put water down so the stone would slide better. Well, they moved stones every two minutes. They had to place a stone every 2 minutes. So if they have water down to make the stone slide easier, the next people pulling a stone would slip in that slick surface.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask an Egyptologist about that, there will be no answer. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. I do. Okay,
you know,
so
it's just bizarre.
Using the method of building that you describe in your book, how long do you estimate it would have taken to build this pyramid?
Around 7 years.
Okay, we have to step away for break. Around 7 years to build it. Astounding. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. When we went away for break, Stephen Myers had just told us his estimate of how long it would take for the Great Pyramid to have been assembled using the method that he has outlined in his book. And Stephen, you said 7 years, right?
Yeah, about 7 years. Water locks the world over are used 24 hours a day. But a mythical mega ramp could only be used, Egyptologists say, during the light of day. So about 7 years is what we've figured. Another thing, if Egyptologists were responsible for building the Great Pyramid, not even one stone would be moved yet.
Do you think, because, you know, you said, and plus it's you say it in your book several times in several different ways, that the Egyptologists have never yet one time done anything the way they say it was done. Do you think that it would be possible to demonstrate your method and build a small pyramid?
Well, a small pyramid wouldn't really be very effective. What would be an effective demonstration is to move full-size stones.
Yeah, but you don't have to go 45 stories. Just demonstrate the method by building a small pyramid, but, I mean, you don't have to go 45 stories, but use the same-size stones.
Certainly. Use full-size stones and just move them and set them in place and have the result similar to the direct physical evidence, which is the Great Pyramid. So if you could move a casing stone, say, and set it on top of another casing stone, that would be pretty remarkable. It would certainly eclipse anything that Egyptology has done in terms of the scientific method. Much of what of the method that the stones are moved have already been demonstrated. In the 1830s, in the Erie Canal again, they moved 70-ton payloads in a ditch 4.5 feet deep. And some of the other things that needed to be done, like moving the stones on and off the barges, that would make a wonderful documentary. We're actually, now that the book is out, we're trying to produce a YouTube video that that shows some of these processes. Many of these processes are quite visual, and the book is well illustrated, but we need a nice YouTube video, and we're going to that with some animations that mm-hmm. we're going to use to pitch for a documentary. So for a TV documentary. So that's actually one of our next goals. I've founded a nonprofit foundation to further the study of understanding these ancient technologies of the Great Pyramid and develop these ancient technologies for our modern but troubled world. And that's called the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation. It's a 501c3 nonprofit. And that's one of our goals, is to do that.
All right, now let's go back to the purpose of the pyramid for just a moment.
Certainly.
There is evidence that there were canals, and as I said, I have seen a documentary where they show you remains of sluice gates. Mm-hmm. But if this is a magnificent infrastructure. And it's used for pumping water, I assume, to the city. There also would have to be some type of canals, aqueducts, pipes, something to carry the water away from the pyramid and to the city. Do you know if any of that has been found?
Herodotus, the 5th century B.C. historian, indicated when he was at the Giza Plateau and described the pyramids, he said that the pyramid next to the Great Pyramid did not have a conduit connected to it as the Great Pyramid did. That historian was eyewitness to a conduit associated with the Great Pyramid. I was at the Giza Plateau, and one of my impressions was the absolute desolation in that area of the ancient artifacts. Much has been removed. 99% of the casing stones and everything are gone. But probably that conduit was used for the water that came out of the Great Pyramid. And the purposes of the pumped water were probably very diverse. Certainly irrigation above the floodplain, just flooding one time a year isn't sufficient for farmland year-round, and you can irrigate above the floodplain with the Great Pyramid, but also you could use it to power heavy machinery. Our Industrial Revolution started with water power.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the United States, it was in the Atlantic Northeast states. Also, you could use it for scientific purposes. You can make compressed air and a whole host of other purposes. I see the Giza Plateau originally more as an industrial park and a scientific center than a place for tombs.
Yeah, I've heard many people that have studied the Great Pyramid say there's absolutely no evidence that it was ever used for a tomb. And then that brings up the question, well, if it wasn't used for a tomb, then for what? You know, because it's I think I'm correct on this. Until the construction of it was either the Eiffel Tower or the Empire State Building, that was the tallest structure on the planet, the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, the Eiffel Tower. Yeah. Can you imagine? It certainly is an interesting structure. It's no ornamentation. No formal writing, inside or out, has survived. No hieroglyphs that were meant to be seen. Oddly shaped passages and chambers inside it. The largest structure in North America, in the United States, ever built was a self-powered water pump. The largest structure and most expensive structure in the whole United States, when built, was the Grand Coulee Dam in Central Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big structure with no ornamentation, built by a river in the middle of a desert. It had oddly shaped passages and chambers, and it is used. It makes a lot of electricity, but its primary purpose of the Grand Coulee Dam is irrigation. So modern mankind built this structure for irrigation, the Grand Coulee Dam. Ancient mankind built a structure probably for one of its purposes was irrigation, but they did it in different manners. The largest structure in Africa is in the Valley of the Nile, and that's the High Aswan Dam. It, too, is a water pump. The electricity is used for a massive irrigation project. So modern people in the Valley of the Nile built a structure with oddly shaped passages and chambers that pumps water.
Mm-hmm.
I'm asserting that ancient mankind built a water pump.
Okay, now this would mean tremendous. Assuming that you're correct about this, that this is a water pump, this would mean a tremendous economic boost to the kingdom of Egypt.
Well, to whoever built it. For the civilization that built it, yes, the Great Pyramid was a machine that transformed the desert into a garden. It was a machine that transformed poverty into prosperity. It transformed servitude into leisure. Yes, whoever built it not as an expense, but as a wise investment. It was built by ancient geniuses who understood some very profound aspects of physics.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad you're here. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that has kept you from being here for the first hour, but we're glad you're here now. One real quick note about our friend Dick Criswell, who appears here on the show from time to time. Dick Criswell is back in the hospital. He's got to have surgery on his heel, but he should make a full recovery and be back out soon. But I was informed of that today and wanted to pass that along to you. Now let's get back to our guest, Stephen Myers. Stephen is the author of a book called The Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid. And we're talking about those lost technologies, how the pyramid was assembled and for what purpose. You know, whenever we stepped away for break, I had just said this would have brought this pyramid, provided it is, as you say, a great water pump. It would have provided tremendous wealth for, as you said, the whatever kingdom had built it. Because, you know, agriculture is the only, even today, it is the only source of renewable wealth. Everything else, we mine it, we take it out of the ground, and then that's it. But agriculture is renewable wealth, and it's the backbone of any prosperous kingdom or nation. And you said that Herodotus, when he saw the pyramid, mentioned that there was a conduit leaving from the Great Pyramid. Now, was it functioning at that time? I know he saw water in a pond around the pyramid, but was there water flowing in that conduit, or did he say?
No. He didn't say, but he understood what its purpose was, that it was a conduit for water. Certainly, what he saw was a lot closer to how the Great Pyramid was originally than certainly what we see the Great Pyramid. It was ancient history even at his time. He was told by the priests that the stones were moved using machines that consisted of short wooden planks, and that has been interpreted to mean levers.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be demonstrated that levers move a 70-ton payload. But water locks, like the Erie Canal, were made, the doors were made of short wooden planks. And in the 1830s, regular people, could move 70-ton payloads. But in the 21st century, Egyptologists can't even move a 16-ton payload, let alone the largest stones. So it's interesting, a lot of the ideas about conduits and canals and short wooden planks for water locks. Inside the Great Pyramid, there was Nile earth that was found by Flanders Petrie, the father of Egyptology, in the 1890s. Nile earth is understood to be sediment inside the Great Pyramid. How interesting that is. So there's a lot of compelling corroboration about the Great Pyramid being a water pump or assembled with water. It's fascinating. The casing stones were cemented together and a watertight. The stones that are the casing stones that are still there, the ones on the outside, there's mm-hmm. a few left, they're still cemented together and watertight. That's not for like a symbolic purpose or to keep the pharaoh's soul from leaking out, but it served a function to assemble the Great Pyramid, which is described in great detail in my book. So it's interesting. Another thing to think about is this Great Pyramid as a water pump would provide great prosperity for the technology in modern times. That if we could develop an alternative and efficient method that to pump water than to use electricity from hydroelectric dams or gasoline-powered water pumps, like in third world countries, if we could develop a cheap way to pump water, we could irrigate farmland cheaper and also use that pumped water to generate electricity. So that's why we developed this nonprofit foundation, to do research and development for this of this ancient technologies to develop products for our modern but very troubled world.
You know, you mentioned the casing stones still being joined watertight.
Yes.
And you mentioned earlier that in the king's chamber there would have been compressed air in the upper part of the chamber, in the upper half, and then water in the lower half. And obviously, in order for it to be compressed, it's got to be not only watertight, it's got to be airtight.
Yes.
And there is no door, there is no entrance to the pyramid. The entrance to the pyramid has been artificially made, one entrance by dynamite. But yeah, there's no door.
Yeah. Well, actually, there's the above that opening that was made by intruders I forget what year it was right now, but the tomb robbers broke a hole into the passages of the Great Pyramid, but the original entrance is about 50 feet up from the bedrock, and it's a descending passage. And we felt water entered the Great Pyramid from the descending passage and went down into the subterranean chamber 100 feet below the bedrock. And that chamber and associated passages acted at one time very similar to a hydraulic ram water pump, and pumped water up through the grotto and up through the mound the Great Pyramid is built on and into the Grand Gallery. That's how the lower part pumped water, and then the upper part pumped water in a different manner, but using the Queen's Chamber and the King's Chamber. So, and then the output of the water pump, the Great Pyramid water pump, was the two King's Chamber.
Are you still with us?
Yes.
Yeah, the two King's Chamber. What? You cut off.
The King's Chamber vents.
Ah.
That go out of the King's Chamber.
So then, by coming out of those two vents, you would have a gravity flow down to the city.
Correct, possibly yes. From the water being pumped up would allow the water to be gravity flow, similar to most towns in the Midwest that are flat have a water tower. Water is pumped up to that, and then that gravity flow supplies water to the city. So that's a similar analogy to what you're saying. So
you know, I can visualize how this works, because I lived in a place called East Timor, and I lived in a jungle town called Vekeke. Its water supply came from a spring on top of a mountain that was about, 5 or 6 kilometers away. And it was gravity-fed, and there were places where it had to go uphill. But in order for that to work, it would flow downhill into a concrete reservoir. And when that concrete reservoir filled up and there was more water flowing in on one side, it pushed water out the other side.
Yeah.
And it would flow slightly uphill and over a little crest, and then downhill again to another reservoir. And so our water came to us entirely gravity flow and from several kilometers away.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
It is. And by the way, all of the pipes were bamboo.
Really?
All the pipes were bamboo.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So they used the materials that were available, because bamboo grows everywhere out there. They used the materials that were available and used hollow out of the bamboo trunk of a small bamboo tree. I guess, well, it's not a tree, but a plant. Yeah. Looks kind of like a tree when they get pretty big. You hollow that out and join them together, and they would wrap it with leaves and tar to join them together.
Wow.
Yeah, and they were watertight, and then that's how we had water. And so, you know, it's not incredible at all to me to think that what you're talking about could be done. And the same technology that builds the pressure, that drives the water higher in the chamber and then out to become gravity-fed to the countryside, that same technology can be used to transport the stones and to put them in place.
Yes, absolutely. So it's not as far-fetched as it seems, but it's been a difficult to get the word out. It's been difficult. The book just came out. We've been doing some research with our foundation, but with opportunities like being on your show, it has really helped to get the word out. And people that become familiar with the research and the ideas tell me that they seem compelling, you know, that it makes sense, as opposed to a mega ramp bigger than the Great Pyramid or all these other ideas. And it is kind of grounded in fact and the laws of physics, that type of thing. It seems to be doable. Like I say, we want to do a documentary with some full-size demonstrations of moving stones, and there's a lot that we're doing at our foundation. We have a number of goals, and people can go to our website, which is www.thepump.org, and find out how they can become involved and be part of our organization.
Well, and by the way, as always, folks, if you click on Stephen's photograph on my website, it will take you to his website. So if you don't remember how to get there, just click on his picture. It'll take you there. All right, I want to open up the telephone line so that we can allow our audience to join us. And, folks, the telephones are open, and the telephone number is 623-444-5889. That will work anywhere on planet Earth and possibly on planet X. 623-444-5889. In Canada and in the United States, there is a toll-free number, and it is 888-223-4599. So if you need to call me toll-free, you can. If you're outside of the USA and outside of Canada, I don't have a toll-free number for out there, but I do have the flash message option on my website for you, and you can just go to kevinsmithshow.com and click on flash message. You'll see it right below Stephen's picture. All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hello, Terry.
Hi. I got a couple of questions for your guest. I think, you know, making the pyramid out to be like a water pump, I read about some channels and it did that, but I think it's much more bigger than that. It's you know, it's technology that we don't understand, more like Tesla. I mean, this thing did a lot more things than that. And I was wondering if the guest knows that the Great Pyramid isn't even the biggest pyramid on the planet, and that there's pyramids on about every continent. Several pyramids on every continent on the world, and you know, and I believe even the Great Pyramid wasn't even the first. I think they date some other ones that they found even older. And what do you think about that?
Well, you brought up some interesting ideas. Certainly, I agree with you that, like Tesla, there was some lost technologies of the Great Pyramid. That's why I titled my book just like that. And we just touch upon a few. The book concentrates on the assembly process, and hopefully I can write another book about some other aspects of lost technologies. But no matter what the Great Pyramid was for, it was assembled. And so that's where we started, with a clean slate to understand how it was put together and then address what it was for. Yes, there's pyramids on all continents, and they all are of differing sizes, differing slopes of the sides, differing materials. Some are made of sun-baked mud brick, but the Great Pyramid seems to be unique in terms of its precision and high technology. Yes, I think it was a multi-purpose device. And I think that the high technology from ancient times can be, if we can understand and develop them, will help our modern but troubled world. Too bad about the oil in the Gulf Coast area. That oil was going to be used among other things, to make electricity. Well, if we could have used an energy-efficient and clean system like the ancients did in the Nile Valley, then maybe we would have a cleaner environment.
Yeah, of course. Well, I understand that they supposedly got that corked off now, and they're starting to pump it into tankers, from what I understand. Two, I think it's, I believe it's more that, you know, man didn't make these things, and I associate it more back to Enoch and that period of time and knowledge and that he received.
Enoch was a man. But Terry, regardless of whether it was Enoch or whether it was aliens and their technology that quarried the stones and built the pyramid, the focus of this book is, okay, so not who did it, but how was this thing put together? Because none of the explanations given by Egyptologists have been demonstrated to work, even though they have tried.
Yeah. Well, like I say, it's,
yes.
I believe it's technology, like Tesla knew, that, you know, that's, it's just not in our grasp to understand. You know, I believe, labor didn't do it. I believe that they were, forged and made by sound waves or, different ways of that, and levitated and things like that. I don't think it was a labor thing at all.
Well, I know this. I know that the Great Pyramid is direct physical evidence of ancient high technology that probably has some values in modern times. You mentioned levitating. There's myths that the stones were levitated in place with great ease. Well, my book asserts that the way they were levitated were using anti-gravity devices called water locks. And those water locks were able to lift the stones with ease and move those stones to their final resting place. And certainly there's more research that needs to be done, but just to say it was a tomb and a whole bunch of sweaty guys on a big ramp pulled stones is a disservice to the ancient geniuses who built the Great Pyramid. Because the Great Pyramid seems to be of such high technology, a lot of people attribute its origin or the technology of its origin from ancient astronauts type of thing or aliens. And I think that the Great Pyramid can be understood and its technology can be applicable to our modern times. And that's what our foundation is all about.
Well, one thing is for sure. Whoever built the pyramid, the Great Pyramid, whether he was alien or human, was smarter than us. Whoever it was,
absolutely,
was smarter
absolutely
than us.
Absolutely.
All right. Yes. But, yeah, go ahead.
Genius is very hard to define, but it's easy to recognize, like Tesla was genius, but where that comes from, it's hard to understand. Well, the ancient builders were geniuses, and us people who aren't as smart as they are have to pick away at the Great Pyramid to try to get an idea of how it was built and to get all the advantages of that ancient technology to help us. So that's what we're doing.
All right, back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hello, Brent.
Stephen, I'll admit that a lot of the evidence does point towards the lock system, but they had to build the walls around the pyramid before they could use it, before they could use the lock system. How do they do that?
Okay, the wall that surrounded the Great Pyramid, that survived up until the 1830s or so, was made of much smaller stones. What now?
It would have had to have been higher than the pyramid.
Incorrect. All it had to be would be high enough to make a pond. And then the first level of casing stones were brought in, and it was a that first level of casing stones was a pond in itself. So you had two ponds, the pond around the Great Pyramid, and then the pond impounded by the first level of casing stones. And there was a water lock that connected those two ponds.
Okay.
Then they brought in the next level of casing stones and set them in place, and then they filled in that pond impounded by the first level of casing stones. And when that pond was filled up, the first level of the Great Pyramid was completed. The outside wall only needed to be high enough to bring in the first level of casing stones. There's a lot of confusion about that, and my book discusses that in great detail. They didn't need an outside wall as high as the Great Pyramid. That's inconsistent with the direct physical evidence. They used the casing stones themselves to impound the pond and a series of water locks up the north side of the Great Pyramid.
Very compelling.
Okay.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Thank you, Brent. 623-444-5889. That is the telephone number worldwide, 623-444-5889. Here in the United States and Canada, we have a toll-free number. It is 888-223-4599. And if you're outside the USA and outside Canada, you can either call our main number, 623-444-5889, or do a flash message. Caller, are you willing to hang on through the break?
Yes.
All right. Hang in there. We'll get to you right after the break. We'll be back, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and we have a caller on hold, so let's go straight to the telephone line. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin from Beaverton.
Hello, Kevin.
I was wondering, what are the possibilities that those who built the pyramids were in trances or were hypnotized and didn't have any knowledge of what they were doing?
Well, the focus of our research is to understand what they did, how they assembled the Great Pyramid, actually, and that is more of our focus than how they came to understand what they did. Our focus is to understand the Great Pyramid and how it operated as the original builders wanted it to, not if people were in trances or if they worshipped crystals or what type of clothes they wore, that type of thing. We're much more interested in the technology than any type of trance state or their religions or their language. We want to know the technology of the Great Pyramid. Does that help?
Sort of. I meant, like, if they were under the influence of, say, like, aliens or something, and then had, like, their memories wiped of it.
Well, you know, anything's possible.
We don't know what their memories have.
Yeah.
What we want to understand is what they did. You know, it's hard to say how they got the knowledge, but we want to understand the knowledge.
All right. Kevin, thanks for the call. Yeah, you know, I have no idea who built the pyramid. I really don't. I do have a pretty good idea of how it was not done.
That's a good thing to know.
Yeah,
Thomas Edison understood 10,000 things that wouldn't work to make a light bulb, and he ultimately made a light bulb. That's important knowledge to understand how it wasn't done.
Mm-hmm.
And you're much farther than the entire science of Egyptology.
Well, the thing is, and I think the reason that there is such an appeal to many people, this idea that it was extraterrestrials involved, is because it is so far, the technology is so far beyond what we understand how to do.
Right.
And your book takes us and it may be that extraterrestrials were involved in providing the high technology to cut the stones so precisely, and that's a possibility. However, the fact that the technology was so far advanced of us, we can't build a pyramid today. Nobody else built one, not like that one. So, we think, well, we're pretty smart, and we've got all this high-tech stuff, and we can't build a pyramid. So it had to be aliens, and maybe it was.
That's a way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it was.
Maybe.
But it's also possible that there's a theory out there that there were high-tech, extremely high-tech civilizations on this planet long before our historical period begins, and that they, for whatever reason, got wiped out. And it's possible that it was they who knew how to do this, and that they did it. I mean, that's a possibility. But it wasn't done with a bunch of slaves dragging rocks, that's for sure.
That's for sure. And many people think that because the technology is so high in ancient Egypt, doesn't have the technology to do what was done, that the Great Pyramid was built much earlier than people think, possibly before the last ice age or the biblical flood or the last catastrophe. So that's certainly a great possibility.
All right, let's go back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Mike from Kentucky calling Kevin.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Mike. Kevin. Hello, Stephen. Stephen, in recent years there seems to have been a theory going around that possibly they didn't move those stones and cut them, but actually poured them as a form of concrete. What's your opinion of that?
That was first proposed by Davidowitz in France. A brilliant scientist who does a lot of research and has a lot of patents in polymers and other things. Possibly some of the stones were poured. There's a lot of people who advocate that theory. There's also a lot of people that are detractors of that theory. You can look up poured stones and Great Pyramid, word search that on the net, and you'll see detailed explanations of people that advocate that idea and also the people that that don't advocate that, and you'll get some very detailed arguments. But it's many of the interior stones seem to be quarried, and so I don't think that that theory is viable for a lot of reasons. You can read all of those on the internet, but those stones had to be moved and set in place. And I everyone has an idea, but I don't think that they were poured like concrete.
Okay, one other question. There's also, as you said earlier in mythology, the idea that sound waves were used, that the priesthood had knowledge of ultrasound, and that they would write on certain verses or whatever on papyrus, put it under the pyramid, strike it with a glass rod that was cut to a certain vibratory length, and the stone would raise up and move a bow shot before it set down. What's the opinion on that?
That's a great opinion. I have a truck driver friend who would like to move heavy payloads without buying diesel fuel. It would be wonderful if that idea could be demonstrated. It would sure help modern mankind An idea like that would be a technology that we could keep a clean environment and still move heavy payloads. But
that's
the only problem
right.
is no one has demonstrated it.
Unless
certainly there's stories about that. There's stories about the stones being effortlessly moved, but we think that is a kernel of truth about the stones being moved on barges in water locks.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks
okay.
for your question.
623-444-5889. That is our main telephone number. It works from anywhere on planet Earth. 888-223-4599 is the toll-free number that will work in the USA and Canada. Outside of the USA, outside of Canada, you can call the main number, or you can send me a flash message with your question. We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love for you to participate in the discussion. There are parts of your book, and I started to say earlier, your book moves us several steps forward in understanding this technology. But there are parts of this theory that already are demonstrated, like the remains of sluice gates, the account of Herodotus telling us about the pond around the pyramid and the conduit coming from the pyramid. So parts of this are already demonstrated.
Certainly there's evidence that can be interpreted to support this theory, and a lot of evidence. And again, people feel that it's kind of compelling that there's a systematic process that is something that actually can be done to assemble the Great Pyramid. So, you know, I appreciate the kind words that you're saying about the book and the theory.
Back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, it's John from Vancouver Island.
Hello, John.
Hi, Kevin. One thing I'm not hearing so far is the amount of accuracy involved in building this pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm getting at is your errors, like if each stone is slightly off, as you build the pyramid up, you're going to be off center at the top by
mm-hmm.
quite a bit. When in fact it's pretty accurate, I don't know, something like within 2 inches off center, something like that. And so
that's very accurate for a large structure.
Yeah, that's right. And so as you build it up, your errors would accumulate, and yet the pyramid demonstrates that there were very few errors. And,
mm-hmm.
and your guest is saying that they had to put a stone in every two minutes. Now, I'm not sure if that's according to his 7-year period or the 20-year period that most archaeologists
That's according
are,
to the 20-year period that Egyptologists say, because the mega ramp that never existed anyway, they could move stones only during the light of day. They couldn't do it at night. So they had to move one stone every 2 minutes for 20 years to build the Great Pyramid. But yes, there's great accuracy in the quarrying and cutting of the precise stones, of the casing stones and the granite stones in the King's Chamber, let's say. They had an exceptional ability for extremely high precision to cut these stones. It's interesting that one of the most precise parts of a car is the cylinders, and it's to have a very tight seal. And we feel that the purpose of the casing stones being extremely large and very precise is so they could be cemented together to make a watertight seal. So that was one purpose of the to justify the extreme precision. Is that what you're getting at?
Well, that's really, yeah, that's interesting. But like we couldn't do that today. And so,
not the way Egyptologists say that it can be done. You can't do it by hand. High precision is not accomplished by hand.
Right.
It's never been demonstrated. So.
So are you like? Do you have an explanation for that level of precision?
What I tell people is that I am superior to the science of Egyptology because I know that the way they say it was done is incorrect. They don't know that, evidently. But I believe that the exact method that they cut those stones, those huge stones, with such extreme precision is a technology that is still lost. And our nonprofit foundation is dedicated to understand that technology. And it would be probably valuable in today's world to be able to cut stones in a precise manner.
Well, I don't think they use copper tools, and not only the precision of building it, but the orientation.
All right. We have to step away for break, and we will continue on the other side of this break. John, thank you for the call. We'll be back, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on final approach here, and that means we only have a few minutes left until we get to the end of the show for this evening. So if you have a question or comment for our guest, Stephen Myers, now is the time to exercise the privilege of calling in. 623-444-5889 or 888-223-4599. You know, one of the people that appears on this show as a guest from time to time is a guy by the name of Walter Bosley. And Walter very often says, when we're talking about UFOs and aliens and things like that, and we talk about some of the anomalous structures on this planet as well as on other planets, he often says, do not underestimate the intelligence and ingenuity of our ancestors. And he says, you know, there's every possibility that ancient civilizations that go in what we call prehistory, they go beyond our written history, there's every possibility that they had technology as high or higher than our own.
Absolutely. I think that they had profound understanding of areas of physics that we are only beginning to understand and, in fact, don't understand. A theme of the book is that the ancients were geniuses much smarter than we give them credit, and that we maybe aren't as smart as we think we are.
Well, I think that's... I think it's self-evident. If...
Yes.
If the pyramid, the Great Pyramid, was not built by extraterrestrials, and I don't know who built it, so it may have been built by extraterrestrials, but if it was not, then it stands as a monument to two things. No matter what its purpose was, it stands today as a monument of two things. One, the extreme intelligence and ingenuity of whatever human race built it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And two, the extreme arrogance of modern man over his own level of ability and technology.
I agree with you 1,000%. You're true on both counts.
All right, so let me ask you about your organization. It's the Pharaoh's Pump, right?
Yes, the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit foundation dedicated to understanding ancient technologies, including that from the Great Pyramid, but also to develop those technologies into applications for our modern but troubled world. So that's what we're all about. Our website for our foundation is thepump.org. So just go there and you'll find out more about the book, find out about our mission statement, our goals, how you can become involved. We need help with a like computer-generated animation, some simple animations that would help. We need help with our website, of course, and need help with the grant writing, someone with that capability, so they can check us out and see what we're doing and what our goals are. Maybe they can be involved in another research trip back to Egypt. So you never know. So hopefully we can get some more involvement, some more exposure for the book, that type of thing. And there's a lot of work to be done.
All right, let me ask you a question. Let's assume your theory is 100% correct. Okay. Do you, at this point, understand how the pyramid functioned as a pump? Do you understand that well enough that you could construct, perhaps you wouldn't have to use all the same methods to move stones and all, you wouldn't even have to use stones. Maybe you could use something else. But to construct a pyramid that would act as a pump and supply irrigation and clean water for some very impoverished area, do you understand it well enough that you could build that and make it work now?
Well, we think we do. We are certainly doing some experimentation and have built some components and sub-assemblies with some very excellent success. But we're not at the point to make a presentation, let me put it that way. There are some patent issues that we need to resolve, and a few other things before we make a full presentation. Certainly, we've had some funding constraints that have made developing a large-scale model that has hurt us. But that's the purpose. The fundamental purpose of our foundation is to redevelop these lost technologies that are discussed in the book to help our modern but troubled world. And the two important applications for this pumped water would be to generate electricity and also irrigation. You don't need stone passages and chambers. You can use polypropylene enclosures and PVC pipe and valves, a number of off-the-shelf components, and also some fabricated components. So that's what we're doing. Certainly experimentation is expensive, but it's not expensive for Egyptologists because they don't do it.
I'm not real sure about this, but I sort of get the feeling you're not impressed with Egyptologists.
No, you know, there's a movement to take out the lies in textbooks, and we're going to start in on Egyptologists too. And if there's, you know, why not?
Well, like I said, I think it's self-evident that it didn't happen the way they describe.
Yeah. So we're doing a lot of things. We have a lot of irons in the fire. Like I say, we're going to develop a documentary, and we're going to develop this ancient technology, and we're doing what we can with the resources we have. You know, we need all the help we can get. There's a lot of interest. You'd be surprised the interest there is. And we need, you know, funding sources are important just for every, you know, for everybody. The economy has been adversely affected some of our funding. So it's an interesting world. And, you know, we're trying to make tomorrow a better place.
Well, I think that certainly is an admirable goal, and I think it's something, if people are interested in clean technology, then some of this ancient technology certainly is a worthy thing to get behind. tomorrow night, my guest is going to be Jerry Wills. He is the executive producer for Expeditions TV. And he's been all over South America and has filmed all kinds of ancient structures. And one of the most amazing things that he has filmed or videotaped has to do with ancient water systems that are still functioning high up in the Andes. And you look at it and you say, how could these people figure this out? Because it is really very precise work, just like what you're talking about.
Yes.
All right, stay on the line with me. I want to thank you for being with us this evening. It's been fascinating, a new and different look, a different perspective on the Great Pyramid, and apparently holds great promise for bringing this technology back to, as he says, a world that desperately needs it. Tomorrow night, be here to hear Jerry Wills. He's always interesting, and I know you'll enjoy it. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.